I'm even going to do the countdown.
How to be Tom Shalhoub. A podcast starring me, Tom Shalhoub. Each week, I explore a topic or speak with someone I find interesting, someone I think you could learn from. By listening, you might gain some insight into what it's like to be Tom Shalhoub. Now, why would anybody want to do that? Well, look, you have to model yourself after someone, right? Might as well be me. I mean, who are you going to be, Albert Einstein? Much easier to start with someone simple, like me. Tom Shalhoub.
That was nice with the countdown and everything. We're here with Sergeant Pete Panuccio. Thank you. Can I call you Pete?
Call me Pete.
Okay. I came to you through Andrea, my booker, Andrea
yes.
Bryant. She's great. And I think you know Andrea, right?
I do, and yeah. She's a fantastic baker.
Well, she is? I didn't even know that.
She's holding out on you. She makes the best cookies and brownies I've ever had.
I mean, she's holding out on me because I gotta learn about Andrea from other people.
If you didn't know that, she's holding out on you. She's really absolutely fantastic baker. Fantastic.
I'm going to have her over, and then she can maybe show my daughters, because they're getting into baking now, but they could use a little bit of, a little bit of help. So let's take a look here. Let's start with this, because I watched this, and I was fascinated by it. This is something great that a lot of people don't know about Fox News Shorts, and I saw this online. So let's take a look at it here, and I'll just stop it whenever the heck I want to.
I can't imagine a more frustrating environment than in New York City right now to be involved in law enforcement. And that's a part of the reason why I'm retired. Third generation NYPD, happy as a clam. I probably would have aged out at some point until you just realize the futility of, what am I doing now? This is insane.
Here in New York, the migrant crisis.
100,000 migrants.
People seeking asylum are crammed together.
Controversial migrant shelter in Brooklyn.
New York.
Tina rises overdose deaths
in New York City.
And a string of robberies and assault.
The attackers under arrest.
Crime in the city.
Have arrived in New York City.
From the time I was a little kid, I knew I was going to be a New York City cop. And I loved every minute of it. I enjoyed it. There was a lot of heartache. There was a lot of bad things that happened along the way. I would do it all over again in a second. It rings of 1990s, New York City. Am I going to get robbed? Is my apartment going to be broken into when I get home? Nobody went into the subways at night. We cleaned the city up. We have a 20-year run. The generation that lives in New York City now, they never had to deal with that because the city was safe. So now we're back to this sense that people feel like the streets are out of control again. People have fear again. And that's something you can't quantify. 2020 was the advent. This is when this came in with the introduction of criminal justice reform and bail reform. Crime is exploding. And then the sanctions, the restrictions, what was already a bad situation, one of the final nails in the coffin for policing in New York City. Police officers.
Okay, I'm gonna stop there because this is what I want to talk about. All right. So this amazing video. How did this come about? How did Fox contact you to do this?
Fox found me. I've been quoted in a couple of New York Post stories. I think I became their go-to guy for disgruntled retired cop. And let's face it, 39 years. I do have some experience. And yeah. They actually called my landline in my house. Other than like people trying to sell me car warranties, nobody's called my house, my landline, in forever.
Yeah.
I spoke to them, and they were like, we'd like to have you on. I said, sure, whatever you need. I was glad to have the opportunity just to be able to get out there and speak, because I think a lot of times the people that have forgotten are the citizens of New York City and the cops.
What about the, you talked to the time period, you said the 90s. Now, when I came to New York, it was early 90s, 91. I think it was 91 because I remember on the way up to New York City from Florida where I was living, we stopped in a bar and we were watching the Super Bowl, and Whitney Houston was singing the national anthem and everyone was going crazy in the bar.
I remember so that.
Whatever year that was, 90 or 91, that's when I moved to New York. And it was just starting. I mean, Dinkins was still in there, I think, in 91, if I'm correct. And maybe we had, or we were just starting the Giuliani era began in the early 90s, essentially. I don't know.
94.
Mixed up in dates and everything. But the cleanup began. We had Bratton, and you were out there at that time, right? And
correct.
What did you see happen with the what we were getting in the media? People were talking about Bratton and the broken windows policing and that kind of approach.
Bratton had been floating around New York City since about 1990. He took over the New York City Transit Police. He had a couple of guys with him, forward-thinking guys. Jack Maple was one of them. And they started with the basics. Trouble stopped right at the turnstile. Like what you see now with people vaulting the turnstiles, that's what was going on in the 90s. And they said, you know what? These are the bad guys. Let's grab them. Sure enough, you would find guys carrying guns, drugs, active warrants, and they started locking people up. Within 1 year, transit crime plummeted. Trains were not safe at all back then, much like they are now. And it was a dicey time. 91 was probably the apogee of the murders in New York City. In 1985, the crime was already trending way up. We got hit with the crack epidemic, and everybody wanted to be a gangster. Anybody could get into the business with a small investment.
Yeah.
And you had these young kids that were just blowing each other out of their shoes left and right. I worked in Bed-Stuy at the time, the 77th precinct, young detective. And that precinct was a mile wide, mile and a half long. And we would have 85 homicides a year within the confines of that small command.
Yeah.
Multiply that across the city. By 91, we were averaging around 2,100 homicides a year. That's a staggering number.
So you're a young cop and you're in Bed-Stuy. Do they assign you there? Would you have chosen that beat?
Well, I'll tell you what's funny. I came on the job. I was actually assigned to Central Park as a rookie cop in 1982. And I'm like, what am I doing here? You know, I wanted to be active and run around. And as luck would have it, there was an old timer there who took me under his wing and really taught me how to be a professional, not to get carried away, not to get upset, how to carry yourself. After about a year, I went into the plainclothes unit in Central Park, the anti-crime unit, which back at that time was probably, I'm going to say ballpark, about 30 to 40 robberies a month, which is quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So we had parked department trucks, we would hide in bushes, we'd follow people, and I enjoyed it. 1985, I was assigned, I went to the narcotics division, and a few months later, the crack epidemic hit. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, the first time I saw crack, I didn't know what it was. I had absolutely no idea what this stuff was. And
what did it look like? It was like, they called it rock. Did it look like rocks?
Yeah, it did. The first time I saw it in a car, we found it. We locked up two old timers who were arrested for heroin. So you always check under the seat when you take prisoners out of the car. There's a vial on there. I have no idea what this was. I asked the boss, I'm like, you got any idea what this is? He's like, never seen it before. Yeah, throw it out. I went to the station house. We were processing these guys, and one of the old timers said to me, he says, officer, you didn't know what that was? I said, I'd never seen it. He goes, that's love drug. I'm like, what is it? He goes, it's crack. He says, once you smoke it, you love it. And within, I'd say a month or two, the particular area I worked, it was flooded. It was everywhere. Crack did bad things to people. People would really debase themselves in trying to get money for crack. Explosion of car, that's when people were putting signs in their car windows that said, no radio inside. And because your car's getting looted every night. Street robberies increased, burglaries. It was a bad, not to mention the homicides, with the warfare between the competing groups.
And was it that much worse than cocaine? Like is it like more addictive, or is it just that it was cheaper, it was more accessible?
It was cheap and powerful. Anybody can get into the game. You buy an ounce of cocaine, mix it up with garbage, whatever it was that they were putting into it, and bang, now you're a player. You're going to quadruple your money easy.
Yeah.
And it wasn't unusual, especially in this 77th precinct back then. So 18-year-old kids driving around in brand-new Mercedes, flashing these huge rolls of cash. But the average lifespan of these guys, one of the studies done back at the time, is maybe 16 months. They were killing each other left and right.
Now, so obviously, that's it. So you got the crack epidemic, the crime's out of control. I remember when I moved to New York, we had the subway cars were, they were basically painted with graffiti over all the windows. Like, you couldn't see out the windows.
Everything. There was some interesting artwork, I have to say, but
yeah,
it's just the look of it. And what does it tell you? Decay, and that the city is out of control. Every subway car, like you said, inside and out, was tagged top to bottom.
Yeah. So the Bratton and the Giuliani regime was able to come in, change all that in fairly quickly. And then there was all this thing about the, you know, the renewal of the city, and other cities were copying this thing as well. And it proved to everybody that it could be done. And people said, okay, we're never going to go back. But as we saw from your video on Fox News Shorts there, it did go back. How is that possible? Like, how did it happen?
Well, Giuliani was no slouch in saying, we're going to clean up the city. Enforcement was targeted. It was vigorous. And pretty much we locked up every bad guy. And even if it was minor stuff, they were going to give you life in jail one day at a time. It was simple as that. If you had warrants, bang, you're going back in. Smoking weed, you're under arrest. They brought a sense of order to the chaos that was going on. There's an expression I used in the Fox clip there, palpable fear. You were scared when you walked out of your house. I mean, depending on where you lived, some of the neighborhoods in Brooklyn were so bad at that time that people would put their kids in the bathtub at night to sleep because of the rounds coming through the windows. Uh-huh. I was living in Manhattan at the time, and it was constant. It was nonstop. People breaking into my car. And I'm a young guy in good shape at that time, carrying a gun. I kept my eyes open, and thousands of people were victimized. So you jump ahead with this vigor and enforcement. Within maybe 2 years, the numbers plummeted. They really dropped. And they kept it up. Now, there was political support at the time. The people had had enough. So when you have the political will in back of the effort, it's going to work. And it did work. So what happens? All of a sudden, people like Disney said, there's some prime real estate there on 42nd Street and 7th Avenue. Jesus, where'd all the drug dealers go? Where'd all the pimps go? Where'd the prostitutes go? They were gone.
Yeah.
And with that came the resurgence of tremendous investment in the city, because it was safe. If you don't have safety, you're not going to have that. This is what we're seeing now. That's great. We built up this great city here. If you can't walk the streets, you don't feel safe in your neighborhood. If you can't go to a restaurant, or you have to worry about your wife and your kids coming back and forth to school, that's a problem.
Yeah,
it really is. But that's what we're back to now.
And do you think it is intentional? You have, there's a lot of politicians who say, look, they're doing this on purpose. They want the chaos. They want to bring the cities down. It's part of their political philosophy. But, you know, I don't want to be so cynical. Is it neglect or is it purposeful? Because we had systems that worked. I know we had, for instance, stop and frisk. I guess they were able to criminalize stop and frisk and make it seem like it was this terrible thing. But really what it was doing, I think it was helping to keep the city safe. So who are the people who are behind that trying to demonize stop and frisk? Do they want the city to be more dangerous?
I ponder this back and forth. You have to remember the difference now is the political conditions on the ground here. You had reasonable people in the city council and city government, politicians, rational people. We no longer have that. Our city council is deranged. Albany, it's. I can't take credit for this term, but someone had said New York City is now a captive city. We've been captured by these ultra leftist progressives. They control Albany. So I don't know how you can keep spouting this line like, oh, everything's okay, everything's good. It's not okay. The numbers that they cite constantly, they'll say, oh, from 21 to 2022, we had this reduction. Let's stop right there. January 1st, 2020 was the introduction of bail reform and criminal justice reform. If you look at the NYPD stats from 2019 versus to what they are now, our numbers are through the roof, but they'll never mention that. I've had some interactions with some of the people on the city council. They're strange people. I don't know how in good conscience you can say, oh, this is working. Is it a gambit to keep their political power? Probably. Do they care? I don't think so. I really don't. It's not like it. Adams, Mayor Adams has been up to Albany a couple of times now. He spoke with Carl Heasty and Andrea Stewart Cousins, saying, you're killing me here. You're killing New York City with the, you know, with the present status of these laws. They laughed at him. Just go home, leave. And that was it. So
he does have, you know, you're saying Adams does have some sense of what's wrong. I know he was complaining about the refugee situation. I didn't know if he just wanted federal money or what.
Oh, they always want money. Yeah, that's a given. The politicians we have today are like the crackheads we had in the 1980s. More is never enough. I want more. Give me money. But what's the net result? Look at some of these nonprofits dealing with the homeless, with the immigrants. They're funneling billions of dollars through these groups. Is there any actual accounting? Where's the money going? No. And that started with de Blasio and his wife when she lost. Thrive NYC was a mental health program funded to the tune of $2.5 billion. She lost $1 billion. I'm like, how do you lose $1 billion? Where did this money go? And if you said a word about it, people say, oh, you're racist. You're picking on her because she's black. No, first off, she's not an elected official, so I don't know why she's running this. I don't know what's in her skill set to run a gigantic nonprofit, but that money's gone. And I have no doubt now that there's similar issues with a lot of money disappearing. And what do we have to show for it? Nothing. We have grief on the streets.
What would it take for someone like Adams to, if Adams did sit down with somebody and say, okay, look, it worked in 91 or whenever this thing started with Bratton. We're going to go to it. We're going to do the more aggressive policing. We're going to have the broken windows theory. We're going to get the squeegee men off the West Side Highway, all this stuff, right? Could he do
that? That's going to require changes with the state legislature. They're the ones.
Why? Why do they state? The city can't just do it?
No, because a lot of the crimes where, like, it's just for instance, the commercial burglary, when I was years later, when I made sergeant and I'm in the anti-crime unit on the Upper East Side, commercial burglars were out there all night long. And I really enjoyed hunting them. That was something I really got a kick out of. Most of them were pretty good at what they did. But now, you know, if we arrested somebody back then, you're going to jail. You're going to be sitting in Rikers for a couple of months, cooling your heels. You're off the streets. Now, these guys with the changes in the law now get desk appearance tickets. Even with certain robberies now, they're eligible for a desk appearance ticket at the station house.
And that means like we've got to get the difference here. The difference between this part of the bail reform thing. You're saying that they sat in Rikers waiting for their trial. And when you say desk appearance, it means they give them a sheet of paper and they say, you're free to go. You got to come back on this date. Is that right?
Yeah. That at the station house, we used to call them disappearance tickets because, hey, here you go. You know, this guy's not coming back.
Yeah.
He might warrant out a few months later.
What's that mean?
You just don't show up for court and you get a warrant on you.
Okay. But most and then it was, you got to get several of these, right? But okay, let's do the warrant out thing. So you bring them in, you give them the ticket, the desk ticket there, and then he warrants out and now he's a wanted man. So then you pick him up on something else and you bring him in. Do you, in this situation, are they letting him go again?
Yeah. When we had rational judges and like normal people that I, you know, working within the criminal justice system, if you warrant out, the judge is going to say, all right, you didn't show up the last time. You're going to Rikers. This way we know where you are for your next court appearance. Yeah. It was, and this is a small percentage of the population. This is a percentage, but these are the people, the repeat offenders. They're not going to change. They're not going to stop. These days, there's no incentive for these people to stop whatever it is they're doing. On January 2nd, 2020, I was still working as a night watch sergeant in Manhattan South. The night before, there was a guy running around the West Village. He did 16 commercial burglaries. So a patrol catches him. 16 commercial burglaries on you, you're going to jail. You are going to Rikers. You're a predicate. And the next night, I get in around midnight, at about 1 o'clock in the morning, the lieutenant from the 6th Precinct calls me up. He goes, you know that guy we got last night? I says, yeah. He says, could you do me a favor? He goes, maybe I'm losing my mind. Maybe my phone, my police phone isn't working. Can you check and see if he's still in? And I checked. He was out 5:30 that next day. He's back doing a burglary, wearing the same clothes that he had on the night before. And I, welcome to the world of bail reform. And there's no incentive. These guys are not going to stop.
There was a guy that tried to, he wielded a box cutter at me in the 90s. I was working for Orangina, you know, the orange juice company.
Good stuff.
And it's great stuff. And so I had a truck and I had bags of ice. And this guy came at me with the box cutter. He was a kind of a crackhead, you know. I don't think he wanted to kill me, but he wanted to scare me or whatever. And he came at me with the box cutter. He ended up cutting my ice open. I didn't get hurt at all, but I called the cops. They came down. We arrested the guy. We found him, arrested him. And then I figured, you know, these guys, street crime, he's probably going to get out. But then they put him in Rikers. And then a few months later, it was approaching the 4th of July weekend, and the assistant DA called me and he said, hey, 4th of July weekend, they tend to let the criminals out before the holiday. So we got to get this guy to trial or, you know, we might lose him and, you know, he might be released. So he said, can you come into a trial? I said, yes. So I went in. They had a trial. They had a prosecutor. He was guilty. He was also, they had a warrant for him for another offense. So they put that on top of it. And he went to jail for 2 years, this guy.
Good.
So, yeah. So that was a very efficient system. It didn't take long. It was a few months. But why can't they get them to trial faster? I mean, to me, if you want to be an advocate for reform, I would say, let's do the speedy trial. These people can't spend 6 months in Rikers and then you find them not guilty. And then, you know, that was 6 months in jail. So could the law and order people make a deal with the human rights people and say, look, no more bail reform. We're not letting these people out. to wait for their court date. What we're going to do is put them in Rikers, but we're going to get them within a week. We're getting them into trial. Why can't they do that?
Yeah, that would be that's been brought up many times over the years.
Yeah.
It's just the way the court system, you know, they say the wheels of justice grind slowly. I'm surprised they grind at all. They go, you have appearances, you have motions, you have hearings. It's a slow process. It was a slow process even back during my day.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get lucky. There's a lot of variables involved here. You have judges. Some judges move fast, some don't. DAs, some of them are very competent, some aren't. Defense attorneys, oh, I can't be in there. I have another trial scheduled this week. And it just goes on and on. It's nothing, it's not new.
Yep.
It's nice that it worked out in your case, but a lot of times, yeah.
Yeah, well, this was at the height. This was right in the middle of the Giuliani administration, and it was kind of law and order was happening. They had already cleaned up Times Square. This guy was one of the, you know, one bad guy, so was still wandering around Times Square. But, yeah, it worked out, and I'm glad I did it because I thought, all right, I'll go down there. And just the impression I had of law and order was this, that I would go in there, and then, you know, his lawyer would get him off. And I thought, well, he didn't stab me. He didn't draw any blood. I bet that they're going to find
I'm actually surprised it went that far, Tom. I really am.
Yeah.
Generally, the vast majority of cases are plea bargained. And they're like, he's already sitting in Rikers Island for 6 months.
Yeah.
The judge is going to say, listen, time served. Take the plea. We'll give you time served. And then you get guys, no, I'm not taking it. All right, well, then we go to trial, and you're going to sit and write until you – bail in those cases is often. He apparently didn't have the resources to make his bail. Generally, it's 10%. You got to put up 10% cash to the bail bondsman. Just for instance, it's a $50,000 bond on you. You or your family has to come up with $5,000.
Oh, I thought that was – so when I hear bail, oh, it's $1 million bail. They don't have to give them $1 million?
10%.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's you know, but people that can afford it, yeah, they can do it. Unless you have a very nice family where someone's willing to put up their house to co-sign on your bail. But then again, if you're a crackhead or a guy going around slashing people, you'd have to be out of your mind. So you're going to sit in Rikers. The thing to remember with all of this is that at that time when Giuliani took over, we still had the laws on the books that where people, when they're arrested, you know, if they were found guilty, they were punished. Those laws no longer exist. In many ways now, the cops are really powerless to do too much. You have an extra set of restrictions that was placed on the NYPD by the city council.
Yeah.
That's just, God forbid, you compress somebody or you're rolling around with somebody and you get a chest compression. These people want you arrested. The police officers in New York City, only city employees now without qualified immunity are the cops. So if you're a transit worker and say you drive your train into the back of another train, the presumption is going to be that you have qualified immunity. That the city is going to cover you. Now we have police officers in certain situations where if you take action and the corporation counsel who would represent you in a trial says, no, we're not going to indemnify you, you're not covered.
And corporation counsel, that's not, you know, the...
It's not the DAs. They're basically the lawyers for the city.
Yeah.
So...
And then you got to have their own lawyers, though, right? Your own advocate that would stand up for you, or...
You have union representation.
Yeah.
But what happens now in these certain cases where this happens, all right, say they sue the city or whatever, and all right, and they give you $250,000. They can sue you personally and take your home.
Yeah.
So what message are you sending the police officers now? Is it worth getting into a fight over nonsense? It's not worth it. Every car stop now has the potential to turn into some kind of huge, as we saw over the weekend with the city councilman. Every car stop has the potential to turn into this gigantic headache. I was never that guy in all the years to sit around and say, I'm not doing nothing. That wasn't me.
Yeah.
Hands on from the day I started till the day I retired. Now I would be hard pressed to tell these cops to go out and say, yeah, go out there and clean up that corner. It's not happening. And it's not going to happen until there's really major changes in the law.
Yeah. Well, you said in the video, you said you were disillusioned, but in terms of your career, you would say, I would go back and do it again. But a young guy, yeah, in a heartbeat. What about a young guy coming to you today, though, and saying, hey, I'm thinking of becoming a cop. Would you say go for it? Or would you say think about it?
Until recently, to me, that would be a heresy to tell someone, don't take the job.
Yeah.
And I'm third generation in my family in law enforcement. My uncle's, his grandson, was thinking about joining the NYPD. And I'm like, listen, you really need to think about this. Because the abuse that these cops are putting up with in the street today, it's insane. I saw it at the end, my last few weeks, because we were in uniform out in the riots every day. The abuse, the nonsense, and you just have to stand there and just suck it up. And over the years, you know, I've been through a lot of riots, a lot of protests. The people yell and carry on. I pay them no mind. Just really just ignore them. But now you have people that are stepping over the line to where they're putting hands on police officers, spitting at them. And I'm not putting up with that. That's not going to happen. And I told him, I says, you really need to think about this. He was an EMT. He was waiting to go to the fire department. And he got an offer to go join the state police. He says, go for it. Go for it. You really should. A couple of years ago, I never would have said that. I would have loved to have seen a fourth generation of my family in the NYPD.
Yeah. So you're saying that to NYPD, but the state police, you said go for it.
Yeah, well, once you get out of the People's Republic of New York City and go upstate, you actually have people that appreciate the work that the cops do and the state troopers.
Yeah.
And they're happy to see you. They really are. There's nobody out there throwing rotten eggs at you, cursing at you. It's just a different world. So, and he's doing quite well. He's way upstate somewhere. He's an outdoorsman.
That's great.
Loves it.
Yeah, so you can hunt. You can go out. You can hike. Okay, let's take a look at some pictures here. Andrea sent these to me, and I think you might have sent them to her. And you can kind of just talk about what they are here. You see police line there. When's that taken?
That was around 2008, 2009, at a pretty spectacular shooting in Harlem. That was a bad one. That was a hot night. And as you can see, I had that look of determination and with my good friend there who was in back of me. And it was just one of those crazy nights. But that was, oftentimes, that was your night. You would be... I was a sergeant, so I'd be sometimes the covering supervisor for four different precincts.
Yeah.
So when these shootings happen, I would be the guy to respond and run the show from there. That was a bad night. That was a particularly bad night.
Let's take a look at this one here. I'm guessing that's 2001, right?
I was not supposed to be anywhere near the Trade Center that day. And as you can see, wound up... we left the van full of cops and one sergeant left. I went afterwards with the lieutenant. I was in the 19th precinct at the time. Unfortunately, three firemen from the station house next door to us jumped in our car. We got to the Trade Center within minutes. I let the firemen out. Yeah. This was just after the first tower collapse. The man next to me is a retired New York City detective, who Marine Corps veteran of the Vietnam War, probably one of the bravest people I ever met. And I was going back into 7th to help him. He had some men trapped in the building. But unfortunately, minutes later, around the corner, on the corner of Essie and West, the second tower came down.
Wow.
He passed away in 2018 from 9/11 and related cancer. Mm-hmm. Two of the three firemen that were with me didn't make it out. They survived the first collapse, but not the second.
Unbelievable. All right. Now let's go back in time here, I think. When is this?
That's my grandfather, Tom Burke.
Oh.
May of 1932. That's him on the right in the fedora. This gentleman and his friend went into a nightclub in Greenwich Village, hauled it up. Subsequently, they got into a shootout in the nightclub with cops that were responding to the scene. There was 50 shots fired, and this guy in the middle was backing through the kitchen firing shots at the cop, at the uniform guys. My grandfather and his partner went through the back of the nightclub, and he didn't want to fire in the direction of the other officers that are out there, and you all still had civilians in the mix of all this. So he picked up a meat hammer that was in the kitchen. And there was a judicial application of the meat hammer, looks like to his head area. But no outcry in 1932. Nobody cared. If you did something like that, you got what you deserved.
I'm wondering, what happened to photography? Look at how classic that photo is. It reminds me of the Jack Ruby photo with the JFK. But, can't we do that today? We have the technology. Everything just looked better back then.
Cameras everywhere, everywhere. And we get garbage photos.
Yeah.
As you can see, this guy here, he didn't look too good when he came out. But dealing at the times 90 years ago, I would say for the shootout that this guy was in, he was lucky to be alive to tell the story.
Yeah.
To me, it's a testament to the patience and the to the police officers of that time with restraint of force. So he should consider himself lucky he got a meat hammer to the noggin.
Fantastic. He looks like Grandpa Munster, that guy, with the bandage on his head. All right, let's take a look at this. This is again 9/11?
This is 9/11. This is later on. It took me all day to find this little crew of cops here from the 19th precinct.
Where's the 19th precinct situated?
On the Upper East Side at 67th Street.
Yeah.
It took us all day to try and track everybody down.
Yeah.
But we did. And this woman, the woman you see kneeling in front of me, Joanne Dowd, I tell people this, one of the toughest campers in the business. She blew her knee out during the first collapse. We were down there till the end of the night. Finally, at the end of the night, I realized this is just a futile situation. I packed up everybody, and I says, we're going to the hospital, and we're getting checked out. Her knee was blown out. And no crying, no complaining, no whining. We stay here till you say it's time to go, Sarge. And eventually, we got back. All the cops in the 19th precinct made it out.
Yeah. And you were a sergeant by 2001?
Yeah, I was a sergeant in uniform doing the midnight shift, midnight to 8.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I got a question here from locals. Let's bring them onto the stage. Locals is my site where I have, fans kind of join me, and I like to kind of involve them if I can. This is CB Michael. I think, Michael, you might be muted. Did I unmute you? You got to unmute yourself, Michael.
There you go.
Now, Michael, were you law enforcement?
I was. I did litigation for the city council boss for years and defended a lot of police officers. And here we have qualified immunity.
Uh-huh. So do you have a question for Sergeant Pete?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What are you looking at? With the DEI situation in New York City, too, I just wonder how the hires are going, the ones that are getting on.
Well, right now, the day I retired, July 30th, 2020, the largest number ever of police officers leaving the NYPD, 180 people retired that day. The DEI stuff, even before I retired, they put a big poster up near the elevator and about which bathroom to use. And I don't know. I've never had that problem in my life, figuring out which bathroom to use and what to do, dealing with a transgender person. And it goes on to say that if a male officer identifies as a female officer now, he can use the female locker room. And I'm like, wow, this is going to be a headache down the line. This is going to be bad. I think there's only three transgender police officers in the NYPD, so it's not this gigantic issue. But it's an issue now, and it's gotten worse since I left.
You know, I'm wondering, Pete, if, you know, you have the thing with Riley Gaines and the swimmers, and we've had other issues like that. But the women I've known who are NYPD, they're not shrinking violets. And I don't know if I would want to get in the get in their face in the locker room.
One morning at the change of shift, just before I retired, my office was across the hall from the female locker room in the precinct I worked in. They all know me. I go walking down the hallway and I said, excuse me, ladies. I says, who's got the combo for the door? And one of them turned around and said to me, she goes, what? I said, stand back. I identify as a female. Open the door. And they started laughing. They got the joke. They were like, yeah, you go in there. You might not come out alive. But somebody will push that envelope. It's going to happen. I don't know. I just, but then I get, I'm one of those guys. I know which bathroom to use. So I don't know. I'm sure DEI has gotten a lot worse since I left. As to people going into the police department, like we discussed before, I think right now it's, if you have a heartbeat, they'll hire you. Cops are coming on, they're going through the police academy, they're getting a few years experience under their belt, and they're leaving. They're going somewhere else. Nobody wants to put up with the nonsense anymore. They really don't.
And yeah, it's so a shame. Thinking, from your perspective, a worse thing than hiring unqualified cops is the fact that the qualified ones are saying, I'm going to call it a day, right?
Yeah, it's a tremendous drain. We go through great expense to train these people, and within a few years, you are a very experienced police officer. These other agencies from all over the country are hawking our guys left and right because they know you're going to have experience of 1 year as a city cop, the NYPD, that you might not have in 10 years somewhere else. And the pay, the benefits, these cops are not staying. And I don't blame them.
Michael, any final questions before we say goodbye to Sergeant Pete?
No, thanks for your service. I said that to a lot of police officers and I meant it.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Well, Sergeant Pete, this was great. Very informative. Thanks for bringing the photos. I'd love to do it again sometime or get together sure. In person. Like I said, I love that. I love that video and I'll post that on Locals, the New York Times, the Fox News short, of you out there in the city, and let's keep in touch.
Will do, Tom. Thank you again. I really appreciate the opportunity because I think a lot of times, like I said earlier on, it's a chance for me to express what a lot of people are feeling and what a lot of police officers are feeling. And they don't always get the chance to get it out there. So thank you again, sir.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for your service. And Michael, thanks for joining us. This is what Locals is all about. I figured you would join us, Michael, when I put that link up there.
It took a while, but I figured it out.
Yeah, right.
I'm in the same boat, Michael. Trust me.
Yeah, he's got the same level of tech savvy as Sergeant Pete. Thanks, guys. We'll call it a day, and we'll see you later.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye. Take care now.
Thanks.